Can you tell us now, you know, this is the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Would you say that 9/11 conspiracy theories are more or less prevalent than they were in the initial aftermath of the attacks?
It's an interesting question. 9/11 conspiracy theories didn't really peak, I would say, until late 2003 and early 2004. And the reason for that is the Iraq War. A lot of people felt deceived by the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they started asking themselves, well, you know, what else have we been misled about? And this led to a natural increase in 9/11 conspiracy theories. And so 2004, 2005, 2006 were – there was a lot of conspiracism. The election of Barack Obama in 2008, I'd say, marked the point where the conspiracy theories started to turn downward, because it was – you know, every good conspiracy theory needs a villain. It's kind of like a Hollywood movie. And when you had Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld in the White House, you know, there was – they were kind of natural villain figures for conspiracy theorists. Obama didn't fit the mold as well. And so since 2009, you've seen, a downward trend in 9/11 conspiracy theories. At the same time, conspiracy theorists have shifted to other conspiracy theories, like financial conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve and so forth. And of course, you have birther conspiracy theories about Barack Obama's birthplace.
Is there something that connects all conspiracy theories? And you have ones on the right, you have ones on the left. Is there a thread ideologically or psychologically that you would say connects conspiracy theorists, even though they might have different politics?
Yes. They share the same basic structure, which is that there is some central overarching puppet master that is controlling all world events in secret, that is highly evil, and that is creating wars and depressions and human suffering in general in order to advance some kind of sinister agenda. And the prototype for this in the modern era is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which, as your listeners will know, is a debunked anti-Semitic hoax that became popular in the early part of the 20th century. And in that conspiracy theory, the Jews were the evildoers, and they were creating wars and depressions and revolutions all over the world so they could cement their hold on the globe. And in the last century, what we've seen is this basic narrative, this basic structure of the conspiracy theory has remained constant. The only thing that's changed is the protagonist has changed. So instead of the Jew, you sometimes will get Catholics, sort of the Vatican, you know, Dan Brown type conspiracy theories. Of course, you get the neocons and the Mossad and the Zionists have a starring role. You get the New World Order conspiracy theorists. You get old-fashioned conspiracy theorists who focus on the Illuminati and Freemasons. But in general, the basic structure is there, that there's going to be this world takeover by some evil, sinister group. And they will use events like 9/11 in order to further their purpose.
Is there an element of truth in any of these conspiracy theories? I mean, let's take the 9/11 conspiracy theory. Is there anything that these people say that is in some small sense accurate?
Many things they say are accurate. You know, if you interview conspiracy theorists, they will often point you to a lot of highly accurate information. They will, in some cases, cite mainstream news articles. They will talk about, in the case of 9/11, they'll talk about the Project for the New American Century. Back more than a decade ago, where right-wing Americans were looking to reshape the world, to make it a safer place. The problem is how they stitch these things together. You know, it's one thing to say accurately that the Americans did want to get rid of Saddam Hussein. You know, regime change in Iraq was the foreign policy of the United States going back to the Clinton era. That's true. It's another thing to then say, well, of course, they then mass murdered thousands of Americans as a pretext to go attack Iraq. So all conspiracy theories, with some few exceptions, have little tiny grains of truth at the base of them. What then happens is those grains of truth are expanded in an obscene way to create Hollywood-style fantasies about great conspiracies.
You talk in your book about one of the reasons why you think conspiracy theories have prominence in America, or what drives them in America, is a sort of libertarian ideal of individualism, which has been supposedly perverted over a history of 250 years and increasing government control and mechanization and whatnot. How does that differ from the sort of environments that give rise to conspiracy theories in other cultures?
Sure. You know, as you say, in the United States, one of the sources of conspiracy theories, especially on the right, is this comparison of the world that the founders lived in, you know, the 18th century, with the world we live in today. And it's true that, you know, as a result of industrialization and higher population density and urbanization and security threats and all that sort of thing, the government has just by necessity become a greater presence in our life. And libertarians in particular look at that and they say this is part of a conspiracy to take away our freedoms. There is no comparable trend in Europe. I mean, in Europe, which has more of a feudal history, it's simply taken for granted that some central authority is going to take care of things for a lot of people. So there's that huge political culture gap between the two societies, which makes conspiracies about big government just much more popular in the United States. In other countries, especially in the developing world, there's a much different narrative for conspiracy theories, which grows out of colonialism. Take a place like Iran, for instance. In Iran, there is a very real history of the CIA and the British engineering real conspiracies in the 1950s to change Iran's government around. And many African countries also, and in Latin America, you have a colonial history where American corporations and politicians and spies really did conspire with, you know, local warlords and such to change governments and take away people's freedoms. And modern conspiracies is an outgrowth of that. In some ways, I have more sympathy for conspiracy theorists in developing countries where they have that history than in a place like the United States, which is an open society and it's much less credible, these conspiracy theories.
You've met with a lot of conspiracy theorists in researching this book. To what extent do you think that they really believe what they're saying? Or is there an element, at least among some of these people, that they know what they're saying is false, but they're doing it for financial gain? Is there money to be made in this racket?
I thought there was money to be made in the racket until I actually interviewed a lot of these people, and I was shocked how little money they have. A good example is this guy Richard Gage, who's a former architect, who's one of the leaders of the 9/11 so-called 9/11 truth movement. He lives out in California. He's been a full-time 9/11 truth activist since 2006. And here's a guy who used to make a six-figure income as a commercial architect. He designed strip malls, basically. And then in 2006, he gave that all up, and he decided he was going to travel the world and tell the truth about 9/11 as he saw it. And now he lives in, I think, a one-bedroom apartment, and he gave up his home and his family. And he makes most of his money from fairly meager speaking fees and selling DVDs. You know, you go to these 9/11 truth conventions and there's guys in the back selling DVDs for 10 bucks each. You don't really get rich doing that. A lot of these people really live hand to mouth. The only two or three people I think who actually have embraced conspiracy theories for commercial gain, you know, someone like perhaps allegedly Alex Jones, who's a prominent radio host out in Texas. You know, he makes a lot of money because he syndicates his radio shows to a lot of people and he sells a lot of merchandise. He's one person. It's possible that he has those motivations. You know, Jesse Ventura has had a TV special, that sort of thing. And another guy is Donald Trump. Donald Trump suddenly came out earlier in 2011 as this great big Barack Obama birther. He wanted to see the birth certificate and he was going to go to Hawaii and he was going to investigate this. And I think a lot of people were dubious about whether he actually believed Barack Obama was born in Kenya. And a lot of people, I think, suspected that this was just a way to get attention and jump to the head of the pack of the GOP presidential hopefuls. I agree with that. I don't think he actually is dumb enough to believe these birther conspiracy theories. I think he just was a clever marketer and realized that this was a good way to market himself as a presidential candidate.
Now, Donald Trump is a relatively mainstream figure in terms of his prominence in the media and whatnot. To what extent do you think conspiracy theories are relegated to the fringe of American life, intellectual life, and to what extent have they managed to seep into the mainstream discourse?
Well, they used to be on the fringes, but if you look at the reason Barack Obama made public his long-form birth certificate was because he was looking at polling numbers and said, wait a second, if you've got 20 or 30 or 40% of Republicans who believe I wasn't born in the United States, statistically that's no longer a fringe phenomenon. The 9/11 truth phenomenon I don't think is a fringe phenomenon. You know, it's decreasing now, but you still have 10, 15, 20% of Americans who believe or suspect that 9/11 was an inside job. And I meet them all the time. You know, you're in a taxi or in a hotel and people just casually talk about it. It's become part of the political culture. And the reason for this is I think the internet. You know, many of the people I interviewed, you know, even fairly mainstream types of people, they just don't have time to read newspapers or watch broadcast television. And they get a lot of their news just from email that their friends send them. And they often fall into correspondence with people, say, hey, check this out, you know, ask legitimate questions about how the Twin Towers fell or whether vaccines cause autism. Or and then they don't educate themselves by reading books or listening to reputable radio broadcasts like this one. And it's a real problem. It's people have insulated themselves from the mainstream respectable media and instead are just getting their information from dubious internet sources.
And so what's the danger of this in terms of conspiracy theories? I mean, they're obviously fun for us to kind of laugh at and make fun of these people, but do they represent a threat to, you know, liberal discourse society?
Sure. And you're already seeing this in the United States. You know, I ask people, how can you have a legitimate conversation about foreign policy and domestic security if you think 9/11 was an inside job hatched by the U.S. government? How can you have a legitimate discussion about healthcare if you think that Barack Obama's healthcare plan was just a big conspiracy to send your grandmother in front of a so-called death panel? If you think that Barack Obama is an illegal alien who's trying to secretly institute some kind of communist Afrocentric Sharia plot in the United States, people who believe these conspiracy theories have basically opted out of reality. They live in an alternative universe, and they're not necessarily dangerous to the United States in that they're going to create some kind of violent revolution. But they're dangerous in the sense that they have eroded the marketplace of ideas to the point that there are just millions of people you can't have a sensible conversation with. And that is a danger to democracy. Democracy requires a well-informed citizenry, people who vote on real issues, people who educate themselves on real issues, and people who you can talk to and you can create a political consensus. The United States is rapidly becoming a place where you can't create a political consensus because people have become radicalized by conspiracy theories.
And so is there a solution to this, or is it just going to get worse with the proliferation of media sources and, you know, popularity of the internet and whatnot?
It's very difficult to rescue someone, if I may use that verb, once they've become a conspiracy theorist. They become immune to rational argumentation. My project in my book was to educate people who are not conspiracy theorists and to show them the basic structure of conspiracy theories so that they recognize them, so that when their brother-in-law sends them the email about Barack Obama or 9/11 or the latest plane crash or, you know, how the U.S. military caused the latest earthquake, they will recognize the structure and claims that have been contained in conspiracy theories for centuries. And they will see that structure and compare it to the information or purported information they're getting and be able to say, hey, this is bunk, and arm themselves with the mental tools required to know when something looks like conspiracist nonsense or when it might be legitimate.
Jonathan Kay, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.